Welcome to the Earth Keepers Podcast. This podcast is for people who seek new and better ways to love and care for the Earth. It's a podcast for anyone who is deeply concerned about the harm being done to the environment on a local and global level. It's a podcast that builds community and connection between people of like heart and mind, people who believe that Earth care should be integrated into every aspect of life, and for many in the Earth Keepers community, that includes our spiritual practices. In this episode, we'll talk with Mary DeYoung, founder of Waymarkers, an organization that offers spiritual formation, education, and guidance. Our conversation focuses in part on the upcoming solstice on December 21st, that day in the wheel of the year when the northern hemisphere is tilted farthest away from the sun. It's the shortest and darkest day of the year, and traditionally marks the start of winter. Of course, it's also the day when the southern hemisphere is tilted furthest toward the sun, thus marking the first day of summer for those in the south. In my conversation with Mary, she helps us to understand the significance of solstice, and from her home in the north, explains how solstice can be a time for wholeheartedly embracing the change of seasons, and even learning to love the dark days of winter. Her larger point, though, is that all of us, whether we are in the north or the south, can learn to hear what the earth is speaking in a language of darkness and light to those who have ears to hear.
That's the story of the earth coming through, a story of the earth that speaks the language of light and dark and deep burial and resurrection. And to be able to witness that in your own particular places is a really, really powerful experience.
Welcome, friends, to the Earth Keepers Podcast. Mary, welcome to the podcast for the second time. Thanks for being with us. For those who haven't heard the first episode that we did, perhaps you could tell us a bit about your life and your world.
Absolutely. Well, it's wonderful to be here with you, Forrest, and with all of you friends who are listening in. This morning, we're talking on a gorgeous, cold, almost wintry day. It feels like winter's already coming in. This is the Pacific Northwest, and I live in the traditional lands of the Duwamish people with much gratitude and honor. And this little pocket of land that I live on is actually called Kwatsich, which is Lasut seed for green and yellow spine. And it's this beautiful little 43-acre pocket of forest on what we now know as Beacon Hill, so kind of Rainier Valley of Seattle. And I live here with my four kids, my partner Joel. We have a flock of chickens that feed us daily, and a little feral kitty named Saint Findus. And my work is in and around deep ecology, spiritual ecology, ecotheology, a real commitment to return and remember the sacramentality of the natural world. That holy mystery is present wholly here, and guiding people, guiding others through writings and retreats, opportunities to teach, to reconnect to this reality, because I really feel like this is how not only will the human community continue to flourish into the future, but the world itself. I believe this holy planet is calling us towards this deep remembrance now more than ever. We might interpret that as a groan. We could see it in the sunrise in the morning, but it's time more than ever to reconnect to this imminent and holy sacred presence of God here.
You lead an organization called Waymarkers. Tell us what that's about and what are some of the ways that you touch people's lives through that work?
Absolutely. Yeah. So through Waymarkers, I do a lot of writing and teaching and lead retreats pre-COVID. And during COVID, now that a lot of that teaching has gone online, where I'm bringing people on a journey of sacred eco-awakening, essentially. And this is a sacred journey of reconnecting faith traditions to the landscape. So this is absolutely a sacramental worldview. It's reconnecting to an imminent reality, that great mystery, holy mystery, God is present here, and that the earth is holy and even a primary incarnation of the divine. So Waymarkers then holds that work, and even its name is, it's coming from the Hebrew scripture and the tradition of the great journey of the return home, as the Hebrew people are wandering these landscapes trying to find return home, they're called to look for waymarkers. And waymarkers actually translates in Hebrew to trees and stones. So this sense that the wild presences, these elemental presences, actually are calling us home. It can help us return home. And again, home being here on this holy, holy, imminent planet.
Now, I've heard you use a really intriguing term before, and that is spiritual ecology or even ecotheology. I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit. It's a fascinating term.
Yeah, well, let's start with spiritual ecology. So I'm actually an urban naturalist, and a lot of my work has been in kind of ecological restoration of urban landscapes, particularly urban forests. And spiritual ecology, it's this intersection of realities that I think calls out the great illusion of separation, that somehow like the environment, the natural world is separate from the human self or the soulscape. And spiritual ecology says, no, we are so interrelated. Our physical human selves, our soul selves are integrated and interrelated with the lands, the environments in which we live. And it invites this opportunity to not only be mirrored by the natural world and to see our lives and our kind of soul journey and our psycho-spiritual formation through the landscape, it also just provides opportunity for profound interrelationship. So yes, this mirroring where we, you know, kind of benefit, but it's also where we begin to not only see nature as a source of energy and sacred presence, but where we in relationship are giving ourselves over to the realities of the natural world, the systems of the natural world. We're leaning into them. We're learning from them. We're sensing into the deep wisdom that resides in these ecological systems, these biospheres. And then ecotheology, I mean, this is really more of a call to account. So trained as a theologian, I get really, really curious about how, in particular, the Judeo-Christian tradition and the stories we've told and how we've told them, many of which slowly emerged a story of separation, especially with the idea maybe of humans being the top of the chain of creation or the crown of creation. And that posture, that severing, that separation from the natural world has caused great violence and harm to the planet and to, I think, people as well. So ecotheology will say, okay, let's look at scripture. Where do we find these stories that perpetuate separation? And where do we actually find stories that are deeply, deeply entrenched in the land? And the wisdom is like really, really coming up through the lilies and not just gracing over those as some cute way for the Christ, you know, for Jesus to tell a story, but really, what are the lilies saying? And when we lean into the wisdom of the lilies, how does that transform how we live in our places?
Mm-hmm. So you lead courses for people that walk through these ideas of connection and spiritual ecology, et cetera. So I want to play a sample from one of your current courses, Wild Winter for People, and we'll talk about that after we listen.
We are living through dark times, and actually literal darkening days, which together I believe are calling us towards a journey of transformation. One must have hope when they begin a new journey, hope that they will get to their place of desire, or even that they will ultimately return home. Together, we are on a journey of rewilding, a journey that will return and reconnect us to the whole assembly of creation and to the wild rhythms of the sacred and the more than human world. This is the deep work of remembering, intellectually remembering that we are nature, that we belong here. And with this living and sacred earth and its process of becoming members again of the whole, the biodynamic and rich communities of life throughout the outer world and remembering the parts and parcels of ourselves that have been severed and separated in the world within, our inner world, our inner nature, our soulscape. This is the work we will be about together, how we bring ourselves back into conversation and communion with sacred seasons and living landscapes out there and in here.
So, Mary, implied in what you're saying in this particular clip, you talk about wholeness and belonging and people reconnecting to their sense of being part of the ecology and part of their place even. But that implies separation, that there's something that needs to be undone or needs to be repaired somehow. Can you talk about what that separation is and maybe what some of the outcomes of being separated from creation might be?
Yeah, so, you know, it's so interesting, especially in our modern times and our modern worldview and all the technologies that are available to us, which can be such gifts, right? Like, this is not, I'm not shaming even the technologies that we're working with right now here and, you know, the amazing gifts that podcasts are. And this illusion of separation has allowed the Western mind, the Western way of living, to be so transient, and I would even say somewhat amnesic. We forget where we are, because really we could be virtually anywhere. And when you don't know where you are, you lose a large potential in knowing who you are. So Indigenous peoples the world over for millennia, their culture, their sense of self, their sense of the sacred was derived from place. They understood who Great Mystery was, who Spirit was, and that influenced who they understood themselves to be, right? Because this is the whole idea of the Imago Dei. We image ourselves after how we imagine God. And if you have an idea that God is separate from the land, separate from the earth, again, residing in some heavenly abode, well, your sense of self is also going to be separate. And your sense of self and identity into a particular place, it'll be non-existent. And so then this is where it kind of intersects even like with broader like global environmental movements. It is far too abstract to care about the earth as a whole. We need to start in the particular and start with our particular places and learn where we are so that we can care for where we are and ultimately love where we are and then hopefully be in solidarity with where we are. So like my particular place, this Kwatsich, has been my teacher. I have been absolutely apprenticed by this place, and I have fallen in love with this 43-acre wood. Even more particularly, I have fallen in love with a Japanese sakura tree in my backyard, who I am in daily conversation with, and believe absolutely that divine wisdom and presence is coming to and through sakura. So separation, and then deeply attuning to the presence of your place is kind of what comes through or is an invitation through these courses. So Wild Winter is really inviting us more broadly into this concept of a wheel of the year, but in particular to bioregional aspects of where we live. So Wild Winter invites a real attunement to mountainscapes, which and the concept of the wheel of the year align with these conversational energies of cardinal directions, the season, and then even the elements. So kind of universally, this concept that there's this wheel of time, wheel of seasons that are happening. Again, this is kind of this sacred ecology intersection. You know, you have the bioregions, you have the ecology acting, not performing, but being in their meant for ways. And this is mirrored within our own psycho-spiritual formation. So Wild Winter invites us to look into the winter of ourselves, which is not something that the Western mind ever wants us to do, right? We don't go dark. We stay bright all the time, producing all the time. Don't rest, right? I mean, it's so countercultural to follow the rhythms of wintertide. So while winter invites that, and it also invites looking at kind of the more northern energetic aspects of your spiritual life. So the cardinal directions each have these kind of archetypal spiritual energies within them. You can find them within Hebrew and Christian scriptures. You can find them throughout the mystics that really deepen into this sense that these directions hold sacred energy that are different from each other. And then the elements. The elements have always been partnered and paired in conversation with these kind of spiritual energetics of the seasons and the directions. And so while winter sees air and wind, the element of breath being in conversation with, again, the generative qualities of north and winter, but it places it all in a bioregion. So yeah, so while winter is playing with making more particular the wheel of the year by introducing actual landscapes where all these kind of spiritual energetics that can seem somewhat ethereal and I don't know, like how do you touch it? Trying to land it in a place, mm-hmm. land it in our particular place so that we can reconnect to our bioregions in a deeply spiritual way, really leaning into the spirit of our place.
So you do talk about the wheel of the year in the Wild Winter course, and perhaps I can play just a clip here, and then I have some more questions to ask you about that as we unpack that term.
The wheel of the year is an ancient way that place-based cultures, indigenous peoples, remembered and celebrated the seasons. While this would have looked different in particular places, there existed universal themes of a profound interconnectedness with the rhythms and cycles of the seasons. So by participating in the seasons through acknowledgement and celebration, the human community was tied to a cosmic and sacred reality. There was a deep sense that our honor and our gratitude would literally rise the sun, that our celebrations would seed the next harvest. The seasons expressed the deep and divine mysteries of the Holy One. This was a profoundly interdependent and co-participatory way of living within the wheel of the year.
So the wheel of the year is a fascinating concept. I fear that as people listen to language like that, the temptation is to make it all very figurative, right? It's just sort of art talk. It's aesthetic language. And then they're sort of looking for what it really means. But my sense is that you are speaking quite literally, right? When you talk about being attuned to the wheel of the year, sort of surrendering to the various meanings of the seasons, practically speaking, what does it really look like to live in that way, to live with that sort of sensibility?
Absolutely. Yeah, well, first and foremost, get rid of any calendar systems that you have in your life that look square or linear and invest in a more circular form of a calendar. So we have one of these actually in a prominent position in our kitchen. So the kids actually turn our calendar. So they have a visual concept that our year is circular. It's a wheel, right? So that in and of itself is kind of this fundamental worldview that you step into, that time is circular. The year itself is more, it's constructed like on a wheel, and that even our formation, our spiritual formation is also circular. Okay, so with that concept in mind, then you're now kind of like putting yourself in the flow of this wheel of time, and you're watching and witnessing what I would even say like the calendar of the earth, and watching and witnessing the seasonal turnings and the seasonal changings as absolutely the biosystems that happen in the earth system and in our bioregions, but also as an invitation to watch and witness for those same permutations, for those same seasonal shifts in our own life. Again, the Western worldview would encourage a very intellectual, kind of light-filled, summer all the time way of living, which is high value of production, high value of work, high value of like being awake all the time. Even how I think we who celebrate, you know, all these holidays during the winter months. I mean, think about all the holiday lights that we string up everywhere, right? it's very hard to lean into darkness. When we are attuning to how the wild world is in winter and see that as an invitation into how we too should be living, could be living, as a way to rest, as a way to become more generative because we've allowed ourselves time for dormancy, our literal physical health can shift. Our spiritual journeys take on whole new life. You know, it's really, I think, exciting to begin to mirror your spiritual life with the wild world. There's so much invitation there. Yeah, just these practical elements of just really kind of waking up to what's going on. And it's also critical now more than ever because climate change is shifting so much. And if we are to be advocates of the requisite needs and demands that our global culture has to make now, if we're not even aware of when the last time it rained, or how much snowpack do you have, or how are the trees behaving or responding to, like in our area, the profound heat that we had end of June? How did that impact Western Red Cedar? If you're not paying attention, and if you're not watching these shifts in the seasons, again, this is another way to speak to how you're not going to care enough to love our planet into a flourishing future, or our human community for that matter either. You know, it's the wheel of the year really invites this collective awareness and really beautiful ways to celebrate too. And it's exciting to see how, for those who practice within the Christian tradition, how a lot of our traditions absolutely align with the wheel of the year. We have our own, you know, liturgical calendar within the Christian tradition that when you lay it on the calendar of the year, it's really fascinating to see like this aligns. So we're coming into Christmastide around the winter solstice. And, you know, at the winter solstice, you're moving into this profound darkness, right? It's the darkest night of the year. So it's this solar event that we're actually participating in. And it's not just a one-day thing. It's actually more almost a 3 to 4 day event, 72 to 96 hours, where that darkness is in its totality. And Christmas Day happens to be at the end of when you can actually, with the human eye, physically see the sun beginning to get brighter, which I think is just a marvelous way, again, to bring in what's happening in the natural world with some of our religious traditions that we practice today. But really aligning like, oh, I can see the light. The light comes on Christmas Day. And that light is all the more powerful because of the darkness that you allowed yourself to be in. I mean, truly, I feel like that's, yes, that's Christmas, but that's the story of the earth coming through. A story of the earth that speaks the language of light and dark, and deep burial and resurrection. And to be able to witness that in your own particular places is a really, really powerful experience.
We've been in conversation with Mary DeYoung about the ways we might become better earth keepers by practicing awareness of the deep significance of seasonal changes. And as Mary has pointed out, those of us in the Northern Hemisphere are entering into our wintertime of quietness and rest in preparation for the new life that comes in spring. In that spirit of rest and renewal, Earthkeepers is going quiet for the rest of the month. James and I will be back at the start of the new year to launch Season 3 of the Earthkeepers podcast. In the meantime, we encourage you to think about creative things you could do to prepare yourself for the coming solstice, and to consider practices that might help you to listen well to the language of light and dark. For now, let's get back to our conversation with Mary DeYoung. So let me tell you how I'm responding to what you said just about Christmas in particular. I hadn't really noticed that coincidence of timing, right? I have outside of my window just a wall of birch trees, and I love waking up to the color in the fall because it's just this wall of yellow, right? And it makes me very happy to see it. We've had a couple of windstorms lately, and I've felt myself tense up because I'm thinking, oh, no, no, don't blow the leaves off those trees, because once the leaves are gone, I'm going to close my blinds and probably not open them until spring, which is kind of sad, you know, because I know what I'm trying to do is avoid the darkness, avoid the what appears on the surface to be barrenness, right, of the bare branches. I just don't want to see them. I think the reason you're evoking that story in me is because I think there is a general tendency in people to want to avoid looking at the dark, seeing the winter as something good, natural, necessary, and even beautiful. So I wonder, you know, if people are looking ahead to the solstice coming up, what are some of the things they might practically do to perhaps shift the way they think about solstice, about the darkest night? Are there practices that can get us sensitized to those markers of the year and maybe not miss some things we might otherwise miss in avoiding the darkness?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for sharing the story of birch. We have birch in our yard too, and so I know that vibrant yellow. I mean, to you in particular, I would say keep those blinds open. You know, maybe that's your practice this solstice time, is to keep those windows open so that you do see the barrenness. Because the birch in particular, when leaf unfurl happens, it's subtle, and it often happens before you would really notice the vibrant green. So you want to be, you know, you want to have those blinds open so you see that, right? But then other things that you can do. So within like the Celtic wheel of the year, the solstices, and in particular winter solstice, would have been a time to light fire. You know, fire is always a very prominent element in celebrating these festivals, these earth-based solar markers. So fire is, I mention that because even bringing in that element allows this conversation between darkness and light. And it's not to give yourself fully over to like wanting the light, but you can begin to just play with fire maybe being your primary light. Maybe you begin as, especially, I mean, in the Pacific Northwest, we're north enough where we're hastening towards darkness. You feel the rapid shift daily. So if you're not having a huge bonfire that you're jumping over and wafting the smoke over your dormant agrarian fields, which most of us aren't. So, right, that's impractical and it's somewhat ancient. Could we still bring in fire in the form of candlelight? And maybe you have a particular solstice candle or even Advent candle. This is where like Advent becomes such a beautiful way to begin to interact with the solstice. But it could almost be reverse. Like instead of adding more candles as you walk closer to Christmas, what if you started with a full set and then removed a candle as you got closer to the solstice so that you're actually, it's getting darker. And you're, yeah, eliminating one candle a day so that by the solstice time, you just have, you know, one candle. So like in our family, we actually practice this a little bit by once Advent comes, we turn off, we like unplug one electric light source in our house every day and replace that with, then we're only lighting a candle so that by the time we actually do come to the solstice, our house is almost in darkness and we are only enjoying the day by candlelight. And it is one of the most beautiful practices. Our children love it. They can't wait for that day when it's just all candles in the house. And they see in that practice a real embracing of the dark. And Wild Winter actually gets into this. We're having a lot of conversation about dark positive spirituality. Unfortunately, I think that the Christian tradition hasn't done a really good job of framing darkness as beautiful and generative and necessary. I mean, I think broad stroke, there's been a traditional negation of darkness, even though life comes from the dark, you know, that's primary. Darkness was present before God called forth light in Genesis, right? So darkness is primary. And that takes a lot of, I think, psychological work for us to get somewhat back. I garden a lot, and you know, this is the time of year where you're planting your bulbs, you know, your springtime bulbs, and doing other garden work. I certainly plant my bulbs with this hope that they will become these gorgeous colors in the spring. But when I place them into the darkness, they don't have a candle down there with them. There's not any additional light sources down there. They are fully in the dark earth, quiet and dormant and resting in the dark. And so in that, I feel this very intriguing invitation to full darkness. And the solstice really, I think, is this time of the year where we are explicitly being called to that. And it's so countercultural because, again, it's happening during holiday time when lights are everywhere and a lot of the like celebrations that you could participate in are, you know, like going to look at lights. You know, our zoo here in Seattle has this gorgeous lantern light festival where you can go like walk through the zoo at night and see all these beautiful animal lanterns. You know, so I just think about that with curiosity, like, huh, like we really set ourselves up to be hard pressed to find a lot of darkness.
Well, in some ways, I think, you know, that pushing back against the darkness refuses to acknowledge darkness as generative, as productive, mm-hmm. because the reason those bulbs are in the darkness for so long is so that they can store up the energy in order to flower then in the spring. Like, you don't plant those bulbs in the spring, you plant them in the fall so that darkness comes, right? So that they have their space in darkness, their time in darkness, to really regenerate, I guess, or to be ready for the light.
Darkness is a requisite. It is a requisite condition for our growth.
This other way of thinking about darkness could even be a help to those who really struggle with seasonal depression. I don't think it is an easy answer, but I wonder, for folks who struggle with winter in particular, if a revisioning of winter could make a difference to them. If they saw winter as beautiful and generative, still dark, but something that in the long run was good.
I think so. And yes, I'm not a trained psychotherapist, and I absolutely honor the realities mm-hmm. of what, you know, seasonal depression type things can bring into someone's life. But I would agree that if we're living in a culture that celebrates and affirms light so much, mm-hmm. then when we move through the dark nights of our soul, or we have real physiological responses to darkness that make us feel like we need to slow down and we need to go under a blanket, that would be characterized absolutely as not healthy. That's not healthy, because you should still be acting as if it's summertime, even though it's dark at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But if we had this dark positive, whether it's spirituality or dark positive, just worldview, then it would full on affirm that fetal position underneath a blanket, because that's what Bear is doing outside. Bear has totally gone underground and curled up. There are so many beautiful examples of how the wild world lives through darkness. And it is slow, and it is deep, and it is quiet, and it is sleepy and dormant. And so if we did have a way of accepting and embracing those postures for ourselves, I think it would reframe so much of how we experience the dark.
Mm-hmm. For people who might want to go deeper into some of the things you're saying, how would they actually get connected to your course, Wild Winter? And what does that look like for them to be involved in that?
Yeah, so Wild Winter is a virtual self-paced course that is really designed to almost be more like a devotional. I have created it to be perennial in its content. So the invitation is that you can return to it again and again and again. So Wild Winter has 5 modules and I think over like 17 segments where you're looking at the particularities again of these kind of conversational energies of season and cardinal direction and element and then bioregional focus and really applying that to your soul journey with the intention of me, I think, companioning you on your journey of sacred eco awakening. So if you are enrolling in Wild Winter, you're joining a cohort of quarterly learners. So there's been a great community that's come around this. And starting just a week before the solstice, I begin to engage the cohort through questions and comments. And the platform that Wild Winter is hosted on allows for really great dialogue. There's been a beautiful community that we've already gone around the wheel of the year together. So there's other wild seasons offerings, spring, summer, and autumn as well. An international community of people who are really deepening into these practices that reconnect them to their place from a sacramental worldview. Winter really, I mean, it does all this invitation work of inviting you into darkness and slowness and the generative wisdom of the elder, which is kind of another component of the north and mountains, and invites play and practice. So there's practices that you're invited into, like if you don't already have like a nature table or a nature altar in your home, Wild Winter has a whole module that talks about why and how you might invite that practice into your life. And then it also invites us into seeing all of our playful ways of enjoying the winter season. We like to ski and we like to sled. So that's participating, right, in your place. I grew up at least believing that my play was not participating in my spiritual life. Wild Winter doubles down on how our play is absolutely a way that we are engaging in relationship with a place. And then I would say with the sacramental worldview that when you are engaging in your place, you are in deep relationship with the body of God. So when I'm skiing on a mountain, I get to hold that is a spiritual practice, that I'm, you know, careening down the side of God's body in my particular place, which is offering me a particular understanding of God's character. And again, because of the particularity of place. So yeah, I think it's a lot of fun and it's been a wonderful community that's grown out of this.
Just to close, I want to extrapolate from this whole darkness and light dichotomy that we've been talking about. Oftentimes at the end of these podcast episodes, I'll ask people, where do you find your hope? It makes me think that perhaps that question can be premature if it avoids the question, where do you despair? What is the source of your despair? Because in the same way that darkness is important in the sort of grander scheme of things, it seems like really allowing ourselves to feel into the despair, especially over climate change and environmental degradation, that's an important part of hope in a way, right? I mean, you need both. Would you agree with that?
I would to an extent. I think that, you know, we have all these couplings of paradox that we have to hold both. You know, I think about like grief and gratitude. And I think despair and hope are another coupling where you hold them both so that you can feel so deeply into the reality of our times. But I say that I agree to an extent because hope, I'm in a really different relationship with hope right now. And I think it's because how I've understood that word in my tradition. Sometimes I feel like, well, we've certainly rushed to hope too quickly. And we allow hope often to be the thing that actually dissuades us from any sort of meaningful activism. So more and more, I'm leaning into courage. I'm at a place with the reality of our times. And I think that the darkness is absolutely speaks to this. I no longer hope that spring is going to come and look like it has during the age from which we've lived through. And even like, you know, the last 800 years, because we are witnessing such rapid climate change. To hope that spring will still come in the way that I've known it, at least even in my lifetime, seems ridiculous at this point. It seems ungrounded in reality. And so that's where this move to courage comes in for me. I have despair. I have eco grief. We have Western red cedars in our area that will not survive because of the heat dome that they experienced in June. And we have a much smaller population of red-tailed hawk in our forest because a lot of the babies jumped out of their nest during that heat dome to try to escape the heat. And just literally, they hadn't fledged yet. So they fell to their death. I feel great despair. And I no longer have a strong hope that things will change that much. So that's where, again, courage. So do I have courage? And actually still, I go back to this image of planting these bulbs. It feels more like courage to nest those bulbs into the dark earth than hope. It is a profoundly courageous act to put something fully into the dark and to not know really what's going to come. And I believe that's what we are being called to now more than ever, is to cultivate practices that give us courage.
We've been in conversation with Mary DeYoung about the ways we all can be more attentive to the movements of the Wheel of the Year. If you are interested in learning more about her upcoming course called Wild Winter, or to read Mary's blog, go to the Waymarkers website at waymarkers.net. That's waymarkers, all one word, .net. For more information about Solstice and other interesting things mentioned in this episode, just go to the show notes for the episode on the Earthkeepers podcast website at www.circlewood.online/earthkeepers. If you appreciate this podcast and want to help us expand its global reach, please consider supporting us and the work of Circlewood, our parent organization, by contributing to our end-of-the-year giving campaign. You can learn how to make a donation by going to our website at circlewood.online. Earthkeepers Podcast explores ways in which we can change ourselves, our communities, and our cultures to help us to care for the earth in holistic and regenerative ways. Through curated conversations, we highlight the wisdom of thought leaders and change agents who are making a difference and showing us a way forward. When Earthkeepers stand together, they amplify the impact of their resistance against environmental injustice and multiply their efforts for renewal and restoration. I am Forrest Inslee, your podcast host. Our executive producer is James Amidon. Our producer is Dave Olfers. Forrest Reed is our editor and the creator of our original music. Our research assistant is Rochelle Nordman. And Jessalyn Meggerly is our social media director. Thank you, friends, for listening. And please join us next time on the Earthkeepers Podcast.